This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, WMUK's Erlene McMichael speaks with organizers of the 10th Annual Summit on Racism, coming up November 14th in Kalamazoo. But first,
Michael Pollan writes about food, how it's grown, prepared, and consumed, and what that says about our culture. He's published numerous books on the subject. The latest is Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Pollan is also the John S. and James L. Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. He will speak Thursday at Western Michigan University's Miller Auditorium as part of the Center for Humanities Healing Arts series. Michael Pollan, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Gordon. Good to be here.
You are coming to Kalamazoo to hold what we're being told is a community conversation about food. But anyone who's read you or listened to you talk knows that when you start talking about food, it's going to branch off into some other areas. Can you kind of give us the idea of the other areas of life that food affects and how it gets there?
Yeah, well, you're right. Food is attached to so many different things. It's one of those areas in life. You know, there's a great quote by John Muir, the 19th century American nature writer, and he said that you could pull on one thread in nature and the whole world comes with it, because everything's connected. So food connects us to the earth, and it has an enormous influence on the environment, on the climate, on the quality of the water and the soil, obviously, but it also is the biggest factor in our health, and whether we're struggling with chronic diseases or not can usually be attributed to our diet. So it connects to health in the largest sense, the health of the environment and the health of the individual. And then, of course, there are the animals that are implicated in our food system and our social life. So much of social life has to do with eating. Are we eating together at meals, or are we eating in our cars alone? This has a huge bearing on the quality of civil life in a society. So we'll talk about that, too.
So how does public policy at the government level end up influencing what we eat?
Well, massively. I mean, it's a mistake to regard the food system we have as natural or even the product of the free market in any sense. It's very much a product of the rules of the game that are written by the government and written by the various corporations that influence the government. So the Farm Bill, for example, you know, is the rules by which the whole game is played. And it is the reason that so many farmers grow corn and soy and nothing else. They're well subsidized for doing that and well insured for doing that. And it is the reason that so many of our animals are on feedlots now. It has to do with incentives built into the food system by government policy. So government policy is very important, and we cannot expect to change the food system without changing government policy. There's lots that's happening outside of policy, of course, and there is this alternative food system that's being built brick by brick right now, and that's very exciting. But to really reach a lot of people with a different kind of food, something that's, you know, more wholesome and more sustainable, is going to require addressing policy. And that is very hard to change. It's very, very locked in because it serves the interests of a lot of different parties. Unfortunately, it doesn't serve the interests of our health or the health of the environment, both of which are really damaged by the food system we have. Look, we're dealing with four of the top 10 killers in America are chronic diseases linked to diet. It is really what kills, you know, most of us sooner or later is things tied to the way we're eating. And yet the government at the same time is subsidizing the least healthy calories in the supermarket.
And give us a little bit of a run-through about how that works. Why is it that the things that are the most unhealthy for us are oftentimes the things that are easiest to afford?
Well, yeah, and that's not an accident. I mean, we subsidize, take corn and soy, for example. We heavily subsidize those, and they're grown on, I think corn is on 100 million acres in the Midwest now, and soy takes turn with corn, of course, in the field. That's the classic rotation. So there's somewhat fewer acres of soy, but not many. They're amazing crops in many ways. They're incredibly efficient ways of getting protein, fat, and carbohydrates off of the land. The problem is they're not really food. Most of the corn and soy that we grow has to be processed. And those two commodity crops, as they're called, are the building blocks of processed food. If you think about corn, it is what feeds the animals that become the feedlot meat and becomes the hamburgers and fast food and the chicken And then if you think about the, and then the corn also becomes the sweetener in the soda in the form of high fructose corn syrup. And on the soy side, the oil from the soy is the fat that most of the fast food is fried in. So we are, as a society, heavily subsidizing these building blocks of a fast food diet. And then you look on the other side, think about the healthier foods, the things that, you know, we're always being told we should eat more of, fruits and vegetables. And you see that there's very little public support. There are no subsidies for fruits and vegetable production. There is some in this last farm bill, which is somewhat more progressive than some previous ones. There is money to research fruits and vegetables to help farmers who want to grow them. And there is, for the first time, money to ensure diversified crops. Because for a long time, and this is another example of the incentives, the only way you could get crop insurance is if you grew a single crop. You had to get a policy for every different crop, and that discouraged people from diversifying. Now we have a program to insure diversified farms, which is a very positive thing in the Farm Bill. But in general, most of the subsidy money is going to subsidize precisely the food the government itself is telling us not to eat. So if you compare my plate, you know, this is the recommendations. It says that 50% of a diet should be fruits and vegetables. That's the official dietary recommendation. What percentage of USDA funding goes to support fruit and vegetable production? 1%. So one hand of the government is telling us eat this way, and the other hand of the government is making it very hard to eat that way.
You've expressed skepticism about what's known as nutritional science. Do you think there are good places for people to go and get information about what is good for them? What are the right foods that they should be eating? Or is it just simply a matter of...
Yeah, they should ask their grandmother.
Okay. Relative common sense?
They'd be better off asking their grandmother than the government. I mean, you know, in the most general terms, the dietary advice out there is pretty good. I mean, the consensus is eat a mostly plant-based diet. Don't eat too much fat. And the government's not allowed to say avoid sugar because of the power of the lobby, but avoid sugar. So we add that to what they say. There is a lot of science that's confusing. So, for example, we were told for many years that we should focus on fat in the diet as the great dietary evil. And we're now learning that, well, maybe sugar is the great dietary evil. So we're undergoing this sea change. And that's, you know, the product of the scientific process. People make conclusions and do studies, and then new science comes along and changes them. The problem is that whenever there's a little bit of science, the food industry often goes off half-cocked and changes everything. And so there was some evidence to make us concerned about saturated fat, and this got translated by the industry into a rush to create no-fat and low-fat foods, which, as it turned out, made us fat. Because when you take the fat out of food, you have to replace it with something. And since you're taking out flavor, it was often replaced with salt or sugar. So when we heeded the advice to cut down on fat, we binged on carbohydrates. And people now realize, as they did not quite then, because the scientific consensus was all about fat, but people now realize that carbs can make you fat, too. And in fact, they may make you fat more reliably than fat does. Fat makes you full, so it kind of checks your consumption, whereas carbohydrates, especially in a liquid form, i.e. soda or fruit juices, doesn't make you full, so you end up eating too many calories. So, you know, I spent 2 years looking at what do we know about nutrition science, and yeah, you leave it somewhat skeptical, somewhat humbled by the difficulty of doing it, and also realizing, though, that while they're working this out, while they're trying to figure out what we should eat and what we should not eat, we have some pretty good guidance, and that is to eat real food. And so my conclusion after those 2 years of study was simply this: eat food, not too much, mostly plants. You don't have to worry about nutrients, good and bad. Those are categories of information that scientists need, but we don't need it as eaters. If you think people ate, you know, have eaten for hundreds of thousands of years before nutrition science even existed, there are other ways to know what to eat, and culture is an important one. That's why I say asking your grandmother is not a stupid thing to do, that it is the novelties in the food system that get us into trouble. So, for example, when we invented margarine, which was supposedly a much healthier fat than butter, the grandmothers who were attached to butter had their authority undermined, and they were told, no, that was backward and dangerous and was going to raise your risk of heart disease. And so everyone switched to margarine, and it turned out that these wonderful polyunsaturated fats were being hydrogenated to make them solid at room temperature, and that the trans fats that were created in the process were truly lethal. And they do give people heart attacks much more reliably than saturated fat does. So I think distrusting novelty in the food system, let foods prove out for 100 years before you start eating them, is a good piece of advice. But there's plenty of real food out there still. It's in the supermarket. You don't have to go to the farmer's market to get it, and you don't have to buy organic to get it. It's just the real stuff that people have been eating for a long time. And if you stick to that and avoid highly processed foods, you've dramatically diminished your risk of chronic diseases.
Now, you mentioned those seven words that you gave as advice back in 2007 for an essay in the New York Times: eat food, not too much, mostly plants. This was over 7 years ago. I'm wondering if you have seen any evidence that people have been heeding that advice, at least more people than were heeding it before you wrote it.
Well, I don't have any science to back that up, but anecdotally, people are, often tell me that those words alone proved enormously helpful to them. And people will sometimes come up to me with a photograph of themselves when they weighed 300 pounds and saying, all I did was start eating real food, and look at me now. And they're very proud, and I'm very pleased to see that. I mean, it's wonderful if something as simple as that can help people. I just don't think we realize how much trouble things like soda get us into, and that it's just not that complicated, that this subject can be simplified, and it's needlessly complicated by industry. But that's because the way you sell people stuff is you make them anxious, and then you offer them a tranquilizer of your product. And that's a lot of what happens in food. The problem is real food, simple food, the stuff that you find in the peripheries of the supermarket, the stuff that, people have been eating for generations. I'm talking about meat and fish and fruits and vegetables and whole grains. They're not that profitable compared to highly processed food. And they don't have big marketing budgets compared to highly processed food. So what gets pushed at us all the time are the more complicated foods. It's hard to make money selling oatmeal to the public, but you can make a lot of money selling an oatmeal-based breakfast cereal or an oatmeal-based cereal bar or energy bar. And every step of processing makes it less healthy and invariably adds more salt and sugar and fat. So you end up taking a healthy grain and turning it into an unhealthy processed food that you can charge a lot more for.
Michael Pollan, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Michael Pollan is an author and educator who will speak Thursday at Western Michigan University's Miller Auditorium as part of the Center for Humanities Healing Arts series. Links with more information about Michael Pollan's appearance Thursday at Western Michigan University, which will also be the Kalamazoo Community Foundation's 2014 community meeting, can be found at WMUK.org.
You're listening to West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Earlene McMichael. An important annual event that examines racial issues celebrates a milestone. The Local Summit on Racism turns 10 years old. Today, we talk about its past and what's planned for its next public meeting on Friday, November 14th. We're joined today by two members of the Planning Committee, Donna Odom and Cherie Thomas. Welcome.
Thank you.
Odom is Executive Director of the Southwest Michigan Black Heritage Society, whose racial healing initiative sponsors the Summit on Racism. And Cherie Thomas is Director of Women's Services for Domestic Violence at the YWCA of Kalamazoo. The YWCA has been putting on the event since the inception of the Summit on Racism. This year, the Racial Healing Initiative takes over the lead coordination in collaboration with the YW, the Kalamazoo County Community Action Agency, Michigan Department of Civil Rights, and the Kalamazoo Valley Museum. Cherie, let's begin the discussion with you. How did the Summit on Racism come about?
Well, initially, some of the key members of Kalamazoo community went to Grand Rapids. There was a Racial Justice Institute being held there in 99. After they came back, they decided to look at Kalamazoo and come up with a community approach to address racism within the community, institutional racism to be specific. From there, they started a series of leadership conferences. Those leadership conferences brought together individuals in the community who held positions in which they could create community impact. Those individuals then came together and had the first Summit on Racism in 2004. And it was held on Western Michigan's campus at the Fetzer Center.
What has been the usual format?
The format for the summits have been to bring in a keynote speaker, typically a national keynote speaker, to have the initiatives break out and share information regarding what they've done throughout the year to address institutional racism in the areas of housing, education, and employment.
There's a reporting out of what happened, but is there also a forecasting or moving forward?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly how it works. So the keynote speaker begins the day for us. The keynote speaker kind of gives us our juice, invigorates us for the day. At that point, after the keynote speaker speaks, then we all break out into our groups based on our initiatives. So we go into our housing, our education, and our employment. Those groups, those initiative leaders who've been working throughout the year in those areas, then facilitate dialogue with members of the community who've come out for the event. They then set the agenda for the next year. So they take the information, all of the things that they've done in the past year to inform what they're going to do in the future to work on eradicating institutional racism in those areas.
10 years is a long time.
It is.
Knowing that there are these three areas, mm-hmm. that you have been very intentional by choosing three areas, mm-hmm. what has been some of the tangible outcomes from the event so that people know it's not just talking, it's really about action?
It really is about action, and that was one of the things we wanted to be clear on from the beginning. The Summit on Racism was very deliberate in not being a research-based institute or a study. We were very deliberate on creating action items. So some of the tangible items that came through were, one, we did housing forums for landlords and for tenants to discuss rights related to institutional racism. So you can recognize it if you're a landlord, practices you shouldn't be doing. And if you're a tenant, those things in which you have recourse for. And the Fair Housing actually helped us to bring those things to the forefront. With the employment group, we created a rubric. And this rubric outlined areas in which an employer can be working on getting rid of institutional racism within its own institution. And the rubric was broken out into four different areas. An employer can see where they fell on that, and then they can be at the bottom, which is beginning, and at the top, which is flourishing. And of course, not surprisingly, no one fell on flourishing, not even those of us who were instrumental in pulling this together. And so it gave us really something tangible to work with. You got a workbook, you got a group that actually helped you to institutionalize practices to eliminate racism in the workplace. And in the education department, there was a group that worked on creating a resource list for teachers who worked in the field, both in elementary, high school, and college level, to bring resources to the classroom to help get rid of racism in education. Also, there was the anti-racism group. That's one of the products that came out of the summit.
I did have one question. I'm interested in that rubric that you were talking about, so that an employer would know where they were kind of on the continuum,
yes.
of kind of institutional racism.
Mm-hmm.
How is that information shared with employers?
So there was a survey. We approached employers, asked them if they wanted to participate in it. If the employer chose to participate, then a survey, an anonymous survey, was given through SurveyMonkey to all of its employees. All of the results came back, and we had a statistician who actually compiled all of the data. And then those results were then given to the employer to let them know exactly what their employees were saying about the environment in which they worked in. And then we worked with them to create an action plan to move them, including training for themselves and staff.
Is that still something that is available if anyone is interested?
Well, I say at this point, they can contact Donna or I, and then we will get them connected.
Very good. Speaking of Donna, we're going to move over to Donna Odom, who has been working really hard on the planning committee. And let's talk about what's different this year.
Yeah, and I should say that last year, actually, we partnered with the YW to begin to continue the Summit on Racism when it looked as though things might not continue, and we didn't want to see that happen. So last year, we called the Summit on Racism Summit on Racism 2.0 to let people know that it was the same but different. And this year, we're working again in the same area, but our theme this year is empowering ourselves to transform our community. And some of the things that are different, number one, last year and this year, we have a panel rather than a keynote speaker. And the panel this year is made up of people who are representing organizations, both for-profit and nonprofit, who have used some of the principles that we have discussed in past summits to transform their companies. Be having representatives from the Whirlpool Corporation, Kalamazoo Community Mental Health, and Open Doors Kalamazoo. And Cherie mentioned that the main areas for the previous years have been education, employment, and housing. Yes. And so those three areas will be represented again through Open Doors, through Whirlpool, and through our education group, which has been the standout network this year. And they will be talking about some of the things that they're going to institute to make some transformative changes in education.
Will you be continuing the kind of breakout format? So you'll have the panel.
We'll have the panel. The speakers will present their programs, and we'll have a question and answer, of course. And then we will break out into groups where we will have members of our committee facilitate the conversation.
The planning committee?
Correct.
Okay.
Facilitate the conversation, and the speakers from the panel will act as resource people. You know, what we try to do with this particular summit, because the Racial Healing Initiative has four main areas: facing history, making connections, healing wounds, and taking action. The summit is our action step. So what we try to do with the summit, just as they did in previous years, is to come away with some action steps, with some ideas that, in this particular case, that companies can use to go back and transform their communities and their cultures.
So you're focusing on institutional racism.
Correct.
Now, what happens with that information once the event is over? Will you be convening, putting that together? How will that work?
Okay. Well, for example, last year we had, you know, basically the same groups, and what we did was form action groups from those conversations. So what we're hoping is that the people who are part of the smaller groups will convene during the year to take action steps towards making changes in their cultures, in their companies.
So you're hoping that the people who participate in your smaller groups will actually want to volunteer to help bring some of the
right.
things that they're suggesting into fruition.
Right. For example, the Whirlpool Corporation has formed affinity groups, mm-hmm. African-American, Latino, and LGBT affinity groups. One of those companies that has representatives in these small groups hopefully will take a look at what they're doing at Whirlpool and want to use some of the information that they get from them to make the same kinds of transformative changes in their companies. So we will be following them to see during the year if those kinds of things are happening in the companies.
I probably skipped a step here, and for our listeners who may not be familiar with your organization, mm-hmm. Racial Healing Initiative, can you just briefly tell them what is it and why would your group be interested in taking the lead coordination of this event?
Right, right. Well, the Racial Healing Initiative actually grew out of the Race Exhibit Initiative, which took place in 2010 as part of the exhibit that was at the Kalamazoo Valley Museum. And what we have based our initiative on is a transforming historical harms approach, which recognizes that the legacy of slavery has left historical harm for all of us. Not just the people who were enslaved, but the enslavers, those who were bystanders, and the descendants of those groups. What we try to do is the four things that I mentioned, is bringing, facing history, showing people what the history has been of racism and ways to move forward, making connections and building relationships across those historical divisions that have kept us apart over the years, and then healing some of the wounds, those traumatic wounds that racism has caused. And then, as I mentioned before, that last step is in taking action and addressing some of those behaviors and structures that are responsible for the ongoing harms of racism.
This event is taking place on Friday, November 14th. It's from 7:30 a.m. to 12 noon. That's quite an investment of time. Who do you hope will show up to this event? Human resource people?
Human resource people. We will also want people in all areas of companies, nonprofit and for-profit. And I should mention that in the past, the summit has actually been a full day. Last year was the first year that we changed that format and made it half a day.
What do you hope people get out of this?
I think it's going to depend a lot on the individual. We realize that some people are going to come into the summit and really have maybe not the same awareness that some of the others of us might have. So we hope that we will, for those people, spark an awareness of some of the issues and problems that we have in the community. For those who have already been working in the area, we hope that we will inspire them to take further steps from what they might be doing presently. And, and that's why we call it our action step, because we want people to go away feeling like there's something they want to do. There's a next step they want to take.
Okay, as we close, I'm looking at a handout that you have here, the role of the Summit on Racism, and you have several points. One of them is to challenge white privilege. Who wants to tackle that?
Okay. I'll talk about that. And white privilege is one of those things that we typically don't talk about in our society, because those who hold the privilege oftentimes don't realize that they even have the privilege. White privilege is something that is unearned. It's something that you didn't do anything for, but you get it just based on your skin. So racism is a combination of privilege and that institutional power that we're talking about. And the way that our society was built, it was actually built, the concept of race, in order to create a separation between people of color and white people. And that privileged the white class. It gave them opportunities that weren't afforded to people of color, specifically African Americans. Mm. And so when we talk about white privilege, we talk about using those unearned privileges that you have, those access that you have to things that other people may not have access to for the greater good. So it doesn't have to be framed in a negative. It can be used for something very positive. And we don't want people to walk away feeling as if I'm a bad person, or being stuck in racism and slavery happened so long ago. Why do we have to talk about this? We want them to get stuck there. That's true, but the legacy of it still lives on today. And this is a point that often sticks with mm-hmm. me, is that we were enslaved longer than we've been free. And that's not something that we often talk about or recognize. Civil rights movement was not that long ago. It wasn't that long that we couldn't all vote or even go to school together. You know, we're talking about in our lifetime. And so because of that, we have a group of citizens, white citizens, who've always had access to things that we could not. And so the playing field isn't level. And so we're asking them to look at that.
Right. And, you know, studies have shown that there's a big gap between the belief about whether or not there is such a thing as white privilege between whites and blacks. And, you know, with programs like this, we hope to raise, as I mentioned before, an awareness among people so that they begin to think about more about this and begin to do some self-examination.
Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
For West Southwest, I'm Earlene McMichael.
WMUK's Earlene McMichael spoke with Donna Odom of the Southwest Michigan Black Heritage Society and Cherie Thomas of the YWCA of Greater Kalamazoo. The 10th Annual Summit on Racism takes place Friday, November 14th at the YWCA of Kalamazoo. It is free and open to the public. Visit our webpage at WMUK.org to learn how to register by the November 7th deadline. On-site registrations will be accepted as space permits. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.